I call to order the Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee. Has anyone reviewed the minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davis. All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. Representative Altendorf.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move HF 1667 before the committee.
And Representative Schumacher, if you would introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For your consideration today, House File 1667 would allow for the water and sewer systems that are formed under Chapter 116A to be defined under the municipality for the purposes of tort liability.
Thank you. And this would be going to the Judiciary Committee?
That is my understanding, Mr. Chair.
And first we'll get the motion.
And Mr. Chair, I would like to move the author's amendment, A1.
Thank you. To the author.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And the A1 amendment changes the enactment date from 25 to 26.
Is there any discussion or questions on the author's amendment? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The author's amendment passes.
Thank you, members.
Continue.
With me today is Dominic Jones, who can speak more to the reasons behind why we're making this effort.
Please introduce yourself and who you're with and continue with your testimony.
My name is Dominic Jones. I'm manager of Red Rock Rural Water System, one of the rural water systems in southwest Minnesota. Mr. Chairman and fellow members, good afternoon. And if it's okay, I'll start my testimony.
Please proceed.
My name, once again, is Dominic Jones. I'm the manager of Red Rock Rural Water System. Our water system is the second largest water system, rural water system, established under 116A in Minnesota. The largest is Lincoln Pipestone Rural Water. And altogether, there are five rural water systems currently in Minnesota. And we are specifically requesting to be included in Minnesota Statute 446. Our rural water entities are all government, not-for-profit organizations, which were created for the sole purpose of drinking water to many thousands of individuals and cities who reside within our system. If the water systems did not exist, those Minnesota residents would have to rely on water from private wells, which most often would not meet the standards of the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. Lincoln Pipestone, for example, currently serves over 5,000 businesses, homes in the rural areas, and 37 cities. Our system, Red Rock Rural Water System, serves 26 homes, businesses in the rural areas, and 15 cities. Many of these cities we now serve could not afford to replace their own water treatment plants. The whole purpose of the tort liability statute is to prevent civil lawsuits from bankrupting government organizations. If Red Rock, LPRW, and the other three rural water systems or sewer systems were on the losing end of a lawsuit which bankrupted them, it would mean thousands of people may not be able to receive safe drinking water or sewer services. Minnesota Statute 446 was first enacted in 1963, which was before any rural water systems or sewer systems were formed in Minnesota. LPRW was formed in 1978. RRWS Red Rock was formed in 1984. Furthermore, Minnesota Statute 116A was enacted in 1971. I would argue that if the water systems existed in 1963, they would have been included as part of the statute. When the statute was initially enacted in 1963, it covered cities, counties, townships, districts, public corporations, and political subdivisions. Since that time, the following government organizations were specifically added to the statute, including county agricultural societies, joint powers boards, public libraries, multi-county library systems, family service collaboratives, children's mental health collaboratives, family service, and community action agencies. Again, I would argue that if Red Rock, Lincoln Pipestone, or any of the water systems established under Minnesota Statute 160A existed when the statute was first enacted, water and sewer systems would have been specifically included in the statute. Therefore, it only makes sense to add it now. Statute 446 states a political subdivision is entitled to a cap on liability, and water districts probably fall under the definition of a political subdivision. However, to avoid the very costly, expensive of hiring an attorney to spend two or more years in court trying to prove that Red Rock is a political subdivision and therefore entitled to have its tort liability capped, I believe we have strong argument that we are a political subdivision. However, one never knows how a judge may rule, and we don't want to waste the valuable resources paying attorneys to argue the point. Having water districts and sewer districts specifically added to the statute would avoid the time and expense of having a judge clarify what we already think is the case. At the end of the day, water districts are government organizations which were established for the full purpose of providing people with safe drinking water. The water districts were created to promote public safety and health, and we do not want that taken away by a potential lawsuit which could bankrupt the system or systems and prevent thousands of people from receiving safe drinking water. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee.
Thank you. Any other testifiers? Seeing none. Are there questions from the members? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. I guess I have two questions. I guess the first, and I don't know who this is better directed to, but I want to better understand if in Minnesota our water and sewer systems are mostly public, or if there are some privates. Just kind of want to understand that distinction, because I think they can be both.
Okay. State your name again. And
Mr. Chair, this is Dominic Jones. We are watched over by all of the state drinking water regulations and the federal drinking water regulations. And, you know, as stated, we think we would fall underneath there. And I understand, you know, that most likely I think we'd be considered that political division. But to our systems that are supplying so much water to so many people in Minnesota, no different than a municipal system, but we're in the rural areas. And so we believe that this would just clarify, just as we have done in a previous bill last year, that we can put a pipeline within road right-of-way, like a county, like the telephone companies that are already authorized to be in there. And so we were named with that, with the help of the Capitol here.
And Representative Lee, before your second question, I can tell you that there are multiple small housing, you know, so like they'll be in a rural area and they'll put up four or six or sometimes maybe a couple dozen homes and they'll have a private well. That would be outside of this and would have, I believe, maybe a little more, loose on the adherence to regulations. I think there have been multiple problems with these private well issues. They're separate from here. But your second question, Representative Lee?
Well, actually, I would just want to stay on this because I want to just better understand the well piece. But my question here is, right, like, so in St. Paul, we have, like, municipal water. And I understand the wanting to balance, limiting liabilities on this because we don't want ratepayers to pay, like, exorbitant amounts, like, when something like that happens, like, you know, Flint, Michigan. But that's why I want to understand, right, like, if the difference between municipal and then, like, something privately owned, right, like, where we're in this space where water is starting to be privatized around the world. It already has been privatized around the world. And so I want to just explore the implications of what we're doing with this bill, which seems like seemingly like very simple, but want to just better understand the impact of this to communities in Minnesota, right? Like if this were to pass, but want to understand this bill is moving to another committee, right?
To the
Mr. Chair, to both of your points there, yes, it's moving the motions to go to the Judiciary Committee. And if you, for the definition of what we're talking about for these water districts themselves, they're the ones that are filed under Chapter 116A, which that chapter title is the Public Water and Sewer Systems. So this would not relate to private providers of water and sewer. It's just the ones that are publicly operated.
And my understanding is that it's not going to change any of the municipalities, their regulations. And it's saying that these would then be treated like similar public utilities. It'd be allowing someone to have the same treatment, not change the existing treatment. Representative Lee, do you need further clarification?
No, and I think, for our purposes here, because we're local government, I'm just asking that question, right, because we're pulling something in to be applied to as, right, like a almost like a municipality. And so that's why I'm asking it. And I think then I'm hoping that when this bill moves to Judiciary, they can ask a little bit more about liabilities and what that looks like between municipalities and, like, maybe private entities, because it also seems like we're making clarification here, but I don't know if this clarification is maybe warranted, and hopefully, like, that stop in Judiciary will help pull that up.
Yeah. Are there any further questions? Representative Greenman.
Thank you. Just a quick question, which is, given that this affects municipalities, have the Association of has the Minnesota League of Cities or the Association of Minnesota Counties weighed in, and are they around to potentially weigh in?
I believe I see the answer to your query, and please state your name and association and help us clarify.
Of course. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. And I had not had a discussion with the House author prior to this meeting, so was not planning on testifying yet. We're going to work on some of our concerns later. But the confusion that the committee is having right now is exactly what our concern is. We believe that under existing language in line 1.13 to 1.14, joint powers boards and organizations created under 47159 or other statute are already covered in this. If you look at 116A, it is a section of statute that allows counties to create a joint powers water structure. So we believe it is already covered by the existing law. And our concern is that then the question is, well, do we have to call out every other type of utility or joint powers as a separate tag in this, or they will all cease to be covered by the liabilities we have in place in this state on public entities right now. And so we believe it does create some confusion, and we don't believe it is necessary. But I have not had a chance to work with the author to discuss those concerns yet, and we're happy to do that before the next committee if this committee chooses to put the bill forward.
I'm wondering, you know, I'm a bit confused because we're specifically adding a small entity to it, and when I read through the bill, it didn't say we're going to include anyone that wants to join in to this definition, and I think it's more of an aspect of the legal ramifications, and therefore some of that discussion would be, you know, the Judiciary Committee, I assume, is going to address that. But Representative Green, did you have, or do you still need clarification?
Yeah, just a follow-up. Thank you, Greenman. Thank you. And I know you know that. So I guess I would just say I appreciate that. I think when we talk about issues like this, I think it is really important. So I just encourage the author. I'm going to vote to move this on because I think it's something that's being worked on, but really make sure that it is built with the cities and counties that will be most impacted and the state agencies. So really, I know our colleagues in Judiciary will dig more in, but want to make sure that before it gets there, that work is done. Thank you.
And thank you. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think continuing to work on this is definitely important. It's still the beginning of session. There's some kinks that are being worked out in the notification process and all that. But, I appreciate that you informed us Thursday afternoon during session that this bill was likely to come up along with the other two. You know, I know the practice in the House is that there be given 3 days notice of any bill hearing. Custom is that is business days. So, you know, this might also come up on the next bill, but I thought I'd bring it up here. But I do think it's important for the public to get a sufficient notice about that these bills are going to be on the agenda as well. And I know the email didn't go out until Friday afternoon that this was coming up. So I do think, you know, some of these issues could have been maybe worked out if that hadn't happened, if that had happened earlier. I do think it might. I know there were some technological issues, and again, it's the beginning of session. So hopefully that sort of notice will get out sooner in the future just so the public can be more adequately notified of what's on the agenda and that these sorts of issues can be brought to members' attention earlier. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
And are there any other questions for members? Is there a desire by the author to make a closing statement?
Not even a little bit, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Altendorf, are you renewing your motion that House File 1667, as amended, pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All in favor, signify by saying aye. All opposed, nay. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you, committee members and chair. Passes.
Okay. If the author of the next bill can come forward, I believe Representative Roach was going to make the motion.
I move for House File 2526 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Registry.
If the author will introduce his bill, introduce yourself and then your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Thanks for having me today. I'd like to introduce, I guess I should introduce myself, Representative Duran. I'd like to say thank you very much for allowing me to present HF 2526 today for you guys, which we believe is a fix in the gap of helping out our first responders. One of the things we have going on right now, especially in the state of Minnesota, is that there is an issue of being able to help out our first responders further than what we need to. And we're finding out that bringing people together and giving them alternate ways to, I guess, seek help is something that we're lacking in the state of Minnesota right now just because of how the law is written. So what we need to do is we're just going to refine the bill and make sure that, or refine the law and make sure that we're able to help out and give our first responders options to seek help where they can. One of the biggest things we need to do is we need to make sure that we're giving help to allow retention in our first responders right now. First responders go to some of the worst things that we can think of, and they are there to continue that job even after that bad incident. So in order for us to be able to give the services to keep people in the job to make sure that they're out there going and help protect us is crucial. This bill is going to allow that. That's going to allow them to be able to seek help and be able to get the services that they need while in the duty itself. So thank you, and I'll pass it off to my testifiers.
Please introduce yourself and go forward.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Chris Tatro. Thank you for having us in here in this bill today. So, as I stated, my name is Chris Tatro. I'm a medically retired Minnesota law enforcement, and I live with PTSD as a result of my service. I now serve as the president of a nonprofit organization called Hometown Hero Outdoors. We provide outdoor recreation for military service members, veterans, and first responders. I'm here today because of the gap in 471895, the local gift ban statute, that is unintentionally creating barriers to prevent mental health support for our first responders. So let me be clear first and foremost, though, this bill is not about gifts, it's not about perks, and it's definitely not about favors. It's about the mental health access and statutory clarity. As someone who ultimately retired because of cumulative trauma, I can tell you that prevention does matter, and access matters, definitely timing also matters. After the tragic loss of the first responders in Burnsville, our nonprofit partnered with licensed providers to organize a structured wellness day. It included equine assisted therapy, resiliency discussions, and peer support programming, all voluntary and designed to help responders process trauma before it compounds. In addition to the wellness day, we organized a peer support angling event on Mille Lacs Lake, something we commonly do. Fishing charters with peers and coworkers provide a structured opportunity to decompress, connect, and reset in a healthy environment. Initially, some officers were told that they could not participate. Firefighters were told they could not participate due to the concerns about the gift ban statute. Later, the interpretation shifted and participation was allowed. But by that point, the uncertainty that held had already made the responders hesitant. When the legal boundary is unclear, hesitation does set in. At the same time, it is not uncommon for public safety agencies to receive food or beverages from a community during a difficult period or loss or stressful times in their community. In some cases, certain activities were permitted while others were being questioned. That inconsistency, not the intent of the law, it creates confusion. In some municipalities, the statutes have been interpreted broadly, applying not only to official actions taken on duty, but also to voluntary off-duty participation in nonprofit-supported wellness programs. I deeply respect strong ethics. Public trust does matter. I wore the badge for years, and I understand that responsibility. But when the interpretation becomes so broad that it discourages a first responder from attending a peer support fishing trip, a wellness retreat, or a trauma recovery event on their own time, we have to ask whether the statute is being applied as intended. Where do we draw that line? If an officer is invited to attend a mental health retreat, if a firefighter is offered a resilience workshop funded by a nonprofit, if a deputy is invited to a peer support weekend with other responders, at what point does support become a prohibited gift? This bill does not weaken the ethics law, it clarifies it. The proposed language is narrow and structured. It applies only to nonprofits whose primary mission is supporting public safety, mental health, or physical wellness, requires participation to be voluntary, prohibits any connection to official action or decision making, and applies broadly to any qualifying nonprofit. It simply draws a clear statutory boundary so city attorneys and departments no longer have to interpret this differently from city to city. Speaking personally, the hardest step for many officers is choosing to seek help in the first place, and I am one that can say that that is true. I have lost colleagues, too many. One was a law enforcement officer and veteran I had known since I was 5 years old, most recently a Forest Lake officer. died of a heart attack. We can't definitely say what contributed to his early demise with his heart, but we know his profession carries cumulative stress. Another colleague, which we all knew each other growing up, the last time I saw him, he told me he wanted to talk, not just about medical retirement PTSD, but about my organization and how we might get involved. At one point, he said to me, I need to look into some PTSD retirement myself. I'm not doing well. This is this last fall in a city south of the Twin Cities. There was something meaningful in that conversation alone, the idea of connection, of purpose, of being around people who understood what this profession carries. We never got to have that follow-up conversation. 3 weeks later, after we spoke, he took his life. This bill's not about rewriting history or assigning blame. It is about making sure that when a first responder is ready to engage, whether that's through counseling, peer support, wellness programs, or simply being around others who understand, there is no legal ambiguity standing in the way. No one is seeking favoritism. No one is asking for special treatment. We are simply asking for consistent statutory clarity so that preventative mental health support is not unintentionally treated as a prohibited gift. If we believe in preventing PTSD, burnout, and suicide, not just responding after tragedy, then we need to remove any legal uncertainty around accessing support. This bill is preventative, it is ethical, it is narrowly tailored, and it ensures that Minnesota's ethic laws do not unintentionally block mental health access and support our first responders. Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for your time.
And thank you. And to the authors, next testifier, please give your name and association.
Yes, Chair. I'm David Titus. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. I don't think in my years I've ever testified in front of this committee, so thank you for having me. I appreciate that. The MPPA represents peace officers across the state. It's reported there's an inconsistency in how Minnesota Statute 471.895 is interpreted and applied. Clear statutory language protects agencies, officers, and municipalities from unintended violations and consequences. Law enforcement in Minnesota continues to face recruitment and retention challenges. Our job is high trauma. While departments provide mental health resources, a stigma and perceived career consequences still exist. When I came on the job, I'm a proud St. Paul retired cop of over 30 years. You never, ever, ever talked about your mental issues, your wellness, because you felt it was going to affect your career. Many officers hesitate to fully engage in internal support systems out of concern for fitness for duty reviews or career impact. External community-based support often supplements pathways for healing. Businesses, nonprofits, and community partners frequently want to provide lawful support to help first responders with wellness. Statutory ambiguity can unintentionally discourage that support. This proposal is not about weakening ethics, laws, or creating loopholes. MPPA supports strong ethical standards. This is about clarity, and this clarity can be part of a formula that keeps cops in squad cars and firefighters on their rigs. Hopefully, long before these professionals think about leaving the job, this could be the answer, this could be the help. Thank you.
To the author, when I read the first responder, that's the squad.
Oh, sorry about that. First responders is the name of the squad that covers Byron and two of the local townships around them. And my wife served in the squad for over a decade, was the head of the squad. And these are volunteers where pager goes off and they're out the door in less than a minute. And they go there and provide many times life-saving activities. And the ambulances can't get there within time, but they can. When I read this, I'm assuming that this is meant for all of those rural volunteer squads, whether they're called first responders or it's a volunteer ambulance service, et cetera, that this is meant for the people that are first on the scene and are helping. But too often, they're there, you know, just to hold their hand as they pass. And I want to thank you for your bill. And is there anything you want to add before we get to the amendments?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Chair. There is a lot of shared trauma throughout the first responder community. And I can give you a couple examples that are pretty bad. And I'll be as generic as I can possibly. Well, what happened was is there was a crash of a vehicle. Well, the guy was still alive. The car started on fire, and there was no way of helping him. So the first responders, the firefighters, the ambulance crew, and the sheriff's deputy, they're all there listening to the screams of this guy. That's huge. Now let's go to another incident where there was a house fire, and there's some children that died in it. Not only is it the sheriff's deputies that got to show up, but the ambulance crew has to carry them out, and the firefighters have to find them. These are all traumas that we all share together. So this is not only going to help us all out, but it's going to help retention, but not only that, but it's going to help the people to keep a good mind when they're going there to help you guys, everybody in our state. This is not a Republican or Democrat thing. This is going to be helping everybody out in our state. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Did someone have an amendment of which they wanted to move?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a couple here. I guess before I move them, I just had a question for the bill author. So last year, I believe it was, we passed the bill related to the public safety officer memorials. I was just wondering if you know, it's kind of important, I think, especially as we're doing committee work, that bill language be consistent. I just wanted, first of all, thank you both for your service, and I do think this bill addresses an important topic, but it is important that that bill, you know, that the language be consistent, that it be crafted specifically to address an issue. So I was just wondering if you had a chance to work with the bill author of that one. It was Representative Berg's bill, I believe.
To the author.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. In regards to that bill, I don't necessarily think that it actually opened or fixed the gap that we saw in this statute here, being able to help out for mental health and gifts and everything else, the consideration for that. I did not work with Representative Berg on that, but this is just fixing the gap that we saw in this.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. I guess, like I said, I do. So the two amendments we had, so just going back to what we discussed on the previous bill, first of all, you know, we did do our best to get stakeholder input to talk with other members, but just given the late notice of the posting, we weren't able to address, you know, the potential issues we see with this bill. So we did get a couple amendments prepared. The goal was generally to make the language consistent with what was in the public safety officer memorial bill. So the A1, I guess I will just move the A1. And hopefully these will be considered friendly amendments. A1 is moved.
Did you want to talk?
Sure. So the A1, the A1 amendment just uses the term public safety officer and references the statute. I believe the term first responders is not actually defined in statute. So I know that was an issue that Representative Berg worked pretty extensively on, just to make sure it was targeted to the right group of people. So this would just make the language consistent. As I said, I hope it would be considered a friendly amendment.
To the author, I believe the earlier bill that was referred to that passed was specifically aimed, like in the metro, you've got, you know, full-time and other officers. Did your choice of first responders, is that aimed to make sure that it would cover those outside of what the normal people think of as public safety officers, or are you wishing to accept this as a friendly amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you know, thank you for the amendment. I will have to say I do not want to support the amendment on this. I think it narrows our scope of what we want to do and helping as many people as we can possible. So I cannot support the amendment at this time.
So discussion on the amendment. Representative Freiberg and then Representative Coulter.
Okay. Maybe I'll go first then, Representative Coulter. I have the definition here that's referenced. It does say public safety officer includes peace officer, correction officer, correction staff person, individual employed on a full-time basis by a state or fire department who's engaged in firefighting, emergency motor vehicle operation, investigation of fires, provision of emergency medical services, hazardous material responder, a legally enrolled member of a volunteer fire department, a good Samaritan, a reserve police officer, a driver or attendant, a first responder who is certified by the Office of EMS, a person other than a state trooper employed by the Commissioner of Public Safety. I guess I'm just curious if the bill author, who would be excluded? It seems to me like it's a very broad definition, so I'm just curious who the bill author thinks would be excluded by this.
To the author.
It was the fact that I don't think it covered the rural people like we wanted to, I guess, and helping with that situation. So it was just unclear for me.
Representative Freiberg. Representative Coulter.
Well, I was actually going to do just that. I'm just curious, can you give some examples of folks who you would want to cover that weren't included in that definition?
To the author.
But I would say it would just be a little bit more of the rural community is what I was really looking at. I was just concerned it would just shrink our ability to help out our first responders maybe a little too much more than what I would like. So,
Representative Coulter, there's a extreme diversity of entities in greater Minnesota with training and et cetera. Oftentimes there may be a fire department and a separate first responder, and the names and exact activities they do is quite diverse. And again, these are all, you know, volunteer outfits that are in rural America or rural Minnesota. Representative Coulter.
Well, we don't need to sort of belabor the point here, but I mean, it does, I mean, for example, because I was thinking in Bloomington, we are in the process still of transitioning from a paid on call, volunteer fire department to a full time. So that's something that's still very much on my mind. And it does, for example, specifically state an individual employed by a fire department. It doesn't, for example, require that they're a full time employee. So, I mean, I'm that's why I'm asking for examples. And I'm hearing only generalities. That, you know, this might cover some other people. And, you know, like it even says, a good Samaritan while complying with the request or direction of a public safety officer to assist the officer. Like folks who happen upon a scene and are providing assistance. And I think the overall point here, you know, Representative Duran, we haven't worked super closely together, but I know you're an honest guy. I don't think you're trying to do anything dishonest. I think you're trying to do a good thing here. And gentlemen, I appreciate you sharing your stories. Those are not easy stories to share under the best of circumstances, and sitting in front of a large group of people like this is not the best of circumstances. So I appreciate you sharing your story. I think the concern here is when we are talking about gift laws and we are using terms that are not defined in law. And if you had created a new definition, we could be talking about that. But right now, this bill, as it stands, expands the gift laws to cover a term that is not defined as far as I know, in state law. And so I think that's, you know, that's where this is important. And I think if we had had more time, and we do still have more time to work on this, I think we could get to a place where it would do exactly what you folks want to do. And this, you know, this amendment, I think, is a sort of first attempt at getting there. So I'm a little perplexed why we're not comfortable at least starting here. And then if more work can be done before this bill were taken up, you know, I think we can do that. So I'm just, it's a little frustrating because we want to help you do a good thing that you're trying to do. Thank you.
Representative Coulter, in these situations, there isn't, under the direction of law enforcement or public safety person. These are the ones that, you know, the volunteers that show up quickly to save a life. And there's no other, they're not part of a fire department, they're not part, frequently aren't. And I think the part you read of a good Samaritan under the direction of, there is no direction of. And oftentimes, there's no one, we've got surrounding squads helping cover coverage when people are away because there's so few. And this adding support is to help those few continue on, because I know specific people. I can picture their faces that after a tragic accident that they were involved in, they couldn't do it anymore. So I'll have the author talk about, you know, if you want to address that was brought up by Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, it wasn't really clear to me that those individuals, like Chair Kawam was talking about, those volunteers and then, you know, possible dispatchers that would share that trauma would be accepted into that realm. So this is just clarifying that a little bit more and cleaning that up a little bit, that we feel that we're going to be able to get the whole group of people that show up, not just a certain few. So,
Representative Coulter, you had a follow?
Yeah, just to be clear, I think it may be worth examining the definition of peace officer, because it does, I mean, it does include a wide variety of folks. I guess, you know, I would just say that if they're folks as defined as public safety officers in statute, odds are that's the vast majority of folks that you're talking about. And if they're just regular people who show up on the scene that aren't public safety officers and aren't employed by police departments or fire departments or county sheriffs or whoever it is, if they're not public employees, then they're not subject to a gift ban anyway. Thank you.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, excuse me, Representative Duran, for bringing this bill, because I think, you know, I have spent a lot of time recently with the first responders, the Minneapolis police officers who responded on the scene after the Annunciation shooting, and what those folks experienced is horrific. I have heard in the Veterans Committee a lot about the work of the Hometown Heroes and the work you do as we think about helping people deal with the long-term trauma and the connections that folks create. And so I really appreciate, and I really appreciate the, like, creating clear statutory language and making sure there's not statutory ambiguity, which I heard. I would like to ask, because I think that I will speak for myself, but I am interested in helping this bill become law. But I think that the question of both the definitions, and I hear what you're saying, Representative Duran, is you're not comfortable accepting that amendment. This, the challenge I have is this goes directly to the general registry, so there's not another opportunity to work on this bill. I'm wondering if you would be willing to lay it over. We can do some of this work so that you're comfortable and the folks who you've been working with are comfortable with the definitions, because, again, I heard you saying part of the reason we're doing this is to make sure, and knowing that the gift ban, and I've heard a lot of this, we don't want it to get in the way of the work and the relationships and the kind of services are being provided. And I think what you're hearing from my colleagues and I is having some definitions. There's a few places in here which are not defined in statute, which could create more ambiguity, not less. So in the interest of actually passing this bill, I'm wondering if you'd be willing to lay it over and in a good faith. This is not a gotcha. I think many of us are uncomfortable with sending it to the General Register today without doing that work. And so wondering if that is one option that we could approach.
To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, in order for to help this bill out and make sure everybody feels comfortable, I have no problem working with you. I'm trying to get this thing through. So I guess if we're looking at either killing this or working on this, I would rather work on this. So. Can I?
Representative Greenman.
It feels like a good option. We should withdraw our amendments, I think, and then lay it over and keep working on it. I think that there's not an intention at all to, like, getting what you have described and what your testifiers described needing. I'm particularly interested in sort of the organizations who provide this work and making sure we're rooting it in that clear statutory language. I think laying it over, continuing to work on it, bringing it up with a little more clarification is what I would suggest if you're willing for that.
And before you respond, the when I saw this, the first thing that came to mind is we don't want to narrow it and leave out some of these groups. And maybe it's eight people in the group, but they are key to the area. So to the author, it is your ship that let us know what you want to do now.
I appreciate that, and you know, if it's going to be in good faith, I have no problem trying to work with our colleagues here to try to get this thing through without any issues. So,
Mr. Chair,
Representative McDonald,
thank you. Just some questions before the author decides to lay it over or to continue to work on it. This is the committee, and this is the area in which we work on it. I would like a House nonpartisan research. Ms. Griffin or Ms. Gehring to explain what the amendment will do or would do to Representative Duran's bill, his bill, House File 2526, specifically. I know that Representative Freiberg mentioned it, but I'd also like to hear it from you to clarify any misunderstandings.
Ms. Griffin.
Chair Quam and members, what the A1 amendment does is it adds a definition of a public safety officer. That definition is in section 299A.41. It's also the definition that's used in the law that passed last year that relates to gifts allowed after an officer is killed in the line of duty. And it replaces an undefined term in the bill, the term first responders, with public safety officers, which would then link back to that defined definition.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, that's what I figured that it was doing. I think just a suggestion to see what this committee members think, and especially the author. And then Ms. Griffin, what would it do if we added under page 2, lines 1 and 6, instead of delete, we would add first responders and public safety officers. Therefore, we're not negating what the author of the bill wants, Representative Duran. It gets to the first responder, and it's addressing issues that Representative Freiberg's A1 amendment, that it also offers public safety officers, which could be a pretty big definition, which I think you'd want clarity and definition. So if that is something that we could discuss, I would like to make an oral amendment if it would be accepted. Oh,
Ms. Griffin, in your answer, because the phrase or title officer is included, my concern is the interpretation by a judge that it's an officer or as stated in the definition, under the direction of, or is in, a lot of them are directed as being, you know, employees, people underneath a police department or a fire department or, you know, an organization, whereas some of these entities really aren't underneath them. In fact, the first responders that I'm familiar with actually have a agreement with local government, but they're not directly under local government. So would just the officer portion possibly be interpreted so that the possible oral amendment would allow the flexibility to cover some of these entities that are not as well defined in code? Ms. Griffin.
Chair Quam and members, so I just want to make sure that I'm following the question. Is the question what is the effect of adding on line 2.6 of the bill and public safety officers after first responders without defining that term, or is it a combination of defining the term public safety officer and adding that language after first responders?
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, Ms. Griffin, I'm not sure whose question you answered. I asked a question, then the chairman threw in his own question too, so I'm kind of confused right now whose question you were asking, answering. So my question is just, if we were able to accept his amendment we would delete under lines 1.14 and add first responders and insert, and I'm going to change my original thought, instead of public safety officers, we could say public safety officials, because some people that are in the public safety that are working aren't necessarily a sworn officer, but they're officials. And that would handle probably what Representative Quam mentioned earlier. So that is my question. What would that do to his bill if we added first responders and public safety officials or officers, whatever word would be best to have no ambiguity and yet have the author's bill complete in the way he wants it?
Chair Quam and Representative McDonald and members, if the request is just to add and public safety officials on line 2.6 after first responders, neither first responders or public safety officials is defined in the bill. Both of those terms would be undefined, and they're not defined in the underlying statute too, in that 471.895. Those aren't included definitions in current law.
Ms. Griffin, if just the what would the oral amendment? First of all, Representative Coulter, would you be interested in the oral amendment of having those two together?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's not actually my amendment, so I'm not going to speak to that. But if I could, I hope I come bearing good news, because I think if we read further down in the definition of public safety officer, you'll find that it actually addresses this very issue. And Representative McDonald, to your point, it does include far more than folks who are sworn officers. In particular, looking at paragraph 8, a driver or attendant, this is included in the definition of whatever the term is, public safety officer, a driver or attendant with a licensed basic or advanced life support transportation service who is engaged in providing emergency care. And it also includes a first responder who is certified by the director of the Office of Emergency Medical Services to perform basic emergency skills before the arrival of a licensed ambulance servant, and who is a member of an organized service recognized by a local political subdivision to respond to medical emergencies to provide initial medical care before the arrival of an ambulance. I think this actually does pretty well cover what you're trying to get at. And it does, yeah, it does also include the Good Samaritan piece that was referenced. So I think, but I will say honestly, Mr. Chair, this whole dialogue, this is why we should be laying this bill over and doing the actual work. We can fix this, but not here in front of everybody.
To the author on, after hearing the additional discussion, I'd like to hear what you feel should be done with your bill at this moment.
Thank you, Chair. After, you know, listening to everybody and hearing a better clarification of things, I would be moving to accept that amendment.
For clarification, you're talking about the originally submitted A1.
Originally submitted A1, yes.
Is there further discussion on the A1 amendment? Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative McDonald. I do appreciate your efforts to kind of creatively try to address this issue and come up with it. And Representative Duran, I do appreciate that you're willing to accept the amendment now as is. I mean, I do think it's a good amendment and probably the direction we should go. I mean, I guess I would go back to what Representative Greenman said earlier, and it sounded like you were potentially open to the possibility of laying the bill over. And again, I want to reiterate kind of what Representative Greenman said. Like, this isn't, you know, this is an important issue, and I think for that reason, it's really important we get the language right. I think as the amendment is, which you're now open, I think that's a step in the direction. I think, you know, we haven't discussed the A2 yet, but I think that addresses some important issues that there are. And I was also going to mention though that, you know, there's a third issue, and that's. And I was going to ask about this during questions. That's the issue of the potential value of any therapy or recreation or just some, you know, a carve out to the gift, because I do have the gift ban, because I do have some concerns that when you're talking about undefined terms like, such as, sorry, I have a mess of amendments in the bill here, recreational activities, wellness days, you know, there is a potential there for things we wouldn't want to happen. So I think it's important to have some limitation on the value of gift. Now, we spent some time trying to come up with an amendment that would do that, but we were having some trouble, you know, just given kind of the late notice that this was posted. We had some trouble finding a thing to tie it to that kind of made sense. And that's the sort of issue I'd be really interested in working with you on. I know our committee members would as well. So this bill doesn't have another committee stop, so I do think this is the logical place to do it. And again, our goal is just to make this language work as well as possible. So if you were still open to potentially laying the bill over just so we could work on some of these issues, I think that would be the best course of action. Just before we start having, you know, votes on this, my hope is you would still consider that. It did sound like you were open to it earlier.
To the author.
I will be interested in working with you guys to make sure that this gets passed. So,
and what I'm hearing is, and my interpretation is that the preference is to lay this bill over and then do some work and have this brought off the table at a later time, because it is very important that we get this in a form that will pass the House and be signed. So is the author okay with that?
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, if it's okay with the author and our committee members, we have a commitment to laying the bill over and get into it later time. It's too ambiguous right there. So I think let's have a commitment to this, to Representative Duran on this important legislation, that we get to it. He'll work with the amendment authors and get the bill in the right form, and let's bring it back next week as soon as possible. I don't think that's too soon. If it can't be, that's fine, but just that ambiguous, let's get to it at a later time. I'm sure Representative Duran would like to get this bill to the General Register and get passed. So if we can have a commitment as our group and our committee that they'll work with it off camera and another day, and we'll bring it back next week if it's ready. How does that sound?
The chair is intent at next week or as soon as possible before the deadline. So I am extremely willing to have this put on the agenda. Chair Freiberg.
Yeah, I think with the qualifier next week, if it's ready, kind of as you said, because, you know, I don't know how long it might take to get the language ready, but certainly I think our intention should be to bring this back once it's in a workable form. And I'm encouraged certainly by what the bill author has said and Chair Quam's commitment as well. So I thank all of the members here for their willingness to do this.
And I have not been involved with a, we're going to lay this over to a specific date. So the intent of both co-chairs and the author is to bring this back so that unless there's objection, I will move that it's laid over. Okay, well, then I'll just lay it over.
Mr. Chair, if you'd like to go ahead and move your bill.
Madam Chair and esteemed colleagues, I would move that House File 68 be approved and moved to the General Registry.
I believe, Mr. Chair, we're going to lay this one over according to my notes.
Okay. Then I will bow to the authority of the chair and my esteemed colleagues to lay this over.
All right. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And seeing there's no amendments, if you would like to describe your bill to the committee, please.
It's fairly straightforward. While I've been in the legislature, I have carried bills and other people have carried bills to allow a county to take an elected position and make it appointive. But over the years, I've had many people from all different areas of the state say that now that person, instead of being accountable to the public, is accountable to the board that appointed them. And there were some discussions back when our Mr. Simon was a representative about retention elections, and that actually there was quite a bit of discussion on different forms of that. But the idea in this bill is straightforward: that counties, a position that was elective and has been moved to appointive, would still stand for a retention election with the same periodicity as one that was elected. So in a general election every 4 years, there would be a retention election. And the effect is to remind the person that their boss are the people and citizens of that jurisdiction, and that they're responsible to them, not to the board. And I think that's a core principle, and that's why I've carried this on several different occasions. So I will stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And does the committee have any questions for Chair Quam? Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just actually, my first question, I think, is probably for Mr. Gehring. So, you know, I know there's a process for moving offices that are elected to appointed positions. My question is, is there a process to sort of go in the reverse? That is, if positions that were, you know, like auditor and so on, that were elected and then have become appointed, is there a process to go through, in essence, to sort of take that back and move them back to elected positions?
Mr. Gehring? Oh, sorry. Ms. Griffin?
Chair Alsendorf and Representative Coulter, there's language about abandonment in the statute that's being amended, where an optional plan can be abandoned by the county. I wonder if you're asking about Section 375A.1205, which has a reverse referendum process for individuals who are appointed.
Representative Coulter, if you want to clarify.
Well, not being as much of an expert on the statute as you are, I honestly don't know if I'm asking about that. I guess my overall question is, like, so a county moves to change this position from elected to appointed, that's not like a permanent change. They can always go back to having these positions elected at some point through some process. Am I correct?
Ms. Griffin.
Chair Altendorf and Representative Coulter, there is a process where they can go back. There's a three-year waiting period. It's in statute.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. That's helpful. I will just say I have some concerns with this idea. I think, first of all, to be frank, since we are talking about appointees, we are talking about employees. And I think you're going to have a hard time hiring an employee whose contract of employment requires an election when they are not, you know, filing and campaigning and doing all of the things that actual candidates for office do. I will just say there is a process if the desire is to go back to an elected position. It's not clear to me sort of what the benefit here is. If the goal is to ensure that folks are held accountable to voters, then, you know, keep the position elected and we can all go home and have ice cream. So that's what I got. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Go ahead, Chair Quam.
First of all, you've got a county with less than 3,000 people, and you don't have anyone that is interested in running. So you've gone to the legislature and asked to be able to have that position appointed. The idea that the people do not like the person that's in that position at a retention election, they could get rid of that person but maintain that the position is appointed because you want someone with the expertise, skills, and et cetera that could do that. And in a small county, and that's been the general reason why they brought it before the legislature, we voted on and passed, to allow to switch it, is to be able to have a person that would be able to do it. And that was a large portion of the debates. So it's not saying, oh, we're going to go back to elective. It's saying, no, we want to replace this person. As for registering as a candidate, et cetera, in retention elections, the person that's holding that is a yes or no, are they going to be allowed to continue for 4 years? And I know that there was quite a bit of debate on retention elections for judges, that Secretary of State Simon and others participated. And this was first brought up around that same time period as a creative way to ensure that person, you know, that position constitutionally was supposed to be elected. So that person is responsible to the people, and have that as the primary thing as opposed to, you know, responsibility to a board that appointed them. And that's the whole difference. The cost of retention, you just have it on the ballot. And it's held at a regular general election with the same periodicity So there, it's not a an additional real cost. There's no, you know, campaign finance activity for the retention. So I honestly, I voted for allowing elective to become appointive on these small counties because that made sense for them. I have felt bad when people have complained that now they don't have a voice. And this is my effort to return the voice to the people, the citizens of that jurisdiction. And that's the whole intent.
Thank you, Chair Quam. Do you have any follow-up? No, okay. Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing this forward, Co-Chair Quam. I mean, it is an interesting idea, and I do think there's certainly value in making sure as many elected, you know, as many public officials as feasible and practicable are elected as possible. You certainly want to have the public to have a voice. I do think when you're talking about positions that require certain technical skill sets, that may not be a perfect fit if you're talking about sort of broad policy decisions that people can, that, you know, anyone should be able to make, then absolutely those should be elected positions. I'm not sure that fits in this case. And I know the law this is relating to is part of a compromise, a bipartisan compromise in 2019 to make some of these positions appointed because of their technical nature. So, and I know there's a letter in your packets, members, from the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Association of County Officers expressing some concerns with the legislation. All that being said, I am glad this is being laid over. I think that's probably the appropriate step so we can, you know, similar to the last bill, if there are, you know, some changes we can make that might address some of those concerns, I think that's certainly a good thing to do, and appreciate that we're having this discussion and that we'll be able to continue to have it and not have to vote this out. So thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Co-Chair Quam.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. Is there any other discussion of the members? Then Chair Quam, closing comments?
Unfortunately, the 48-page closing speech I left at home. So thank you, and we'll see each other on Wednesday.
Okay, thank you. With that, I lay file 68 over for possible inclusion. And with that, members, we are adjourned today.